Hey, it's Jeff and Jeremy from the Ultra Running Guys. And if you're here, you probably already know that we started this podcast to help you take your next step in your ultra running journey.
But what you may not know is that in addition to this podcast, we also host two live races in the Wilmington, North Carolina area that are designed to do the same.
The first is the Final Countdown, which takes place on September 16th. And whether you've never run before or you're a hardcore ultra veteran, this race is designed to help you find your limits. And we'll be there to help celebrate with you.
And we have now opened registration for the Hydra, which will take place on April 20th and has a 50K individual, a 50K relay, and a half marathon option. Whatever option you choose, we promise that slaying the Hydra will be unlike any race you've ever experienced.
All right, so mark your calendars, share with your friends, and visit us at theultrarunningguys.com or check out the links in the show notes for more info.
And with that, enjoy the episode. And remember, when in doubt, just show up.
When that voice in your head, those little demons in your head are telling you it's too hard, you have to stop. You can't make it. That's why I do it. I want to keep facing my demons and I want to keep facing them down. I want to keep conquering my toughest adversary is myself.
And welcome back to the Ultra Running Guys. You got Jeremy Reynolds and Jeff Winchester of the Ultra Running Guys. And the reason that we're here is to help you take your next step in your ultra running journey. To the Ultra Running Guys family, as always, thank you so much for tuning in. It means the world to us. And I have to ask, of course, if you're finding value, please share with your friends. Give us the review, give us the rating, all that good stuff. It really helps us attract great guests. And speaking of great guests, you have to bear with me because this intro is going to be a little bit long, but I am incredibly excited about
it. It's a well-deserved long one, though.
Very well-deserved. All right. So one of our favorite parts of hosting this podcast is getting the opportunity to learn from our guests. And sometimes we learn from their advice, but most often we learn from their stories. And our guest tonight is using his amazing story to not only teach and inspire, but to literally help change the lives of our nation's heroes. So after serving in the military for 14 years, this gentleman was wounded by an improvised explosive device, leaving him completely blind. But not one to make excuses, he made the necessary adjustments and began racking up a string of accomplishments until 4 years later, a complication from his initial injuries resulted in a case of bacterial meningitis, which also completely robbed him of his hearing. Rather than give up, this warrior did what warriors do, and he forged a path forward. Now, despite being completely blind and deaf, our guest tonight sets the example as a loving husband and father, a successful entrepreneur, the host of the Point of Impact podcast, and an accomplished ultra runner, having completed the Canal Corridor twice.
It's a good one.
Which we just talked about on the show, the Daytona 100, and just a few weeks ago, finishing the world famous Badwater 135. So stick around to hear what drives him, how he's using his story to help others, and what it takes to develop this kind of no excuses mindset. And with that, Aaron Hale, welcome to the show, man.
Well, thank you guys. And that was an incredible introduction. I really appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you for your service as well.
Well, absolutely. And thank you for your service. We're going to talk about your military experience here in a minute. We talked about this a little bit before we started rolling, but I'm going to ask the obvious question for the listeners, right? So we just introduced you as completely blind, completely deaf, yet you've got your own podcast. You're answering our questions. So for the listeners, explain how all this is happening.
Well, obviously, you learn how to speak in Braille.
And he's got an excellent sense of humor, we're finding out.
Yeah, these are prosthetic eyes. And I forgot to ask in the beginning before we start recording to do, you know, like the military body check. Did I have these things screwed in straight? it's funny. I gave my wife, we wrote our own vows for the wedding, and she promised to keep the house full of bacon and bourbon. And I promised to never let my eye wander. Unfortunately, every time I like rub some of the gook out of my prosthetic, I tend to spin it around. It looks like I have a lazy eye. So while she's kept her vows, I have not kept mine. Yes. Okay. So yeah, totally blind, totally deaf. My eyes are gone. I have prosthetics. My ears are completely shut off. Now, the only way I get input is through this cochlear implant, which it looks a lot like a hearing aid. It sits on the ear, but unlike a hearing aid, it doesn't take sound and then amplify it and send it down the ear canal. It actually takes it, digitizes it, and sends it to the implant inside, and that goes to an electrode attached to the auditory nerve. And it sends a digital sound, which my brain had to learn how to decode and learn how to hear a whole entirely different way. I tell people kind of sounds like trying to figure out what's going on in the kitchen through the drive-through speaker. Nothing like the real thing, but way better than the alternative.
Right.
It's incredible to me what science can do.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say is, you know, thank God for technology, because we're really excited about this conversation. And obviously all the different things that you do, being able to kind of cut through some of the things that I think would stop people. And we're going to talk about your mindset, which I think is the probably the biggest tool you've got. But let's start with your story. So I talked about in the beginning kind of your injury, but for those listening, you spent 14 years in the military. I know you spent part of that as a cook in the Navy, doing it sounded like a pretty cush job for a Navy commander. But we're going to fast forward to you ended up transferring to the Army, to EOD. And so being an Air Force guy, obviously we've got EOD as well. And for those listening, it's Explosive Ordnance Disposal. And I would reckon to say that it's probably one of the most dangerous jobs in the military. And so as soon as you hear that, you go, okay, this is like a guy that wants to be a gunner. This is like a guy that, you know, wants to get behind enemy lines. There's certain jobs where you say, that's different. What makes somebody want to do that kind of thing? So why EOD? What attracted you to that in the first place?
When I got my first confirmed kill with a cheesecake, I decided to start saving lives instead.
Poor commander.
Well, I did have a pretty cush job as a cook. I worked my way up to cooking for the three-star, the commander of the 6th Fleet in Gaeta, Italy. And it was fantastic. I was home-ported in Italy. Hardship duty, it was not. I enlisted in 1999. It was time of peace, and I joined as a cook. So before I left Italy, there were two wars going on. Even though I was in, you know, the big blue Navy, I was out there doing my part in the big machine. I was watching both wars unfold on television, on the news. I felt like a draw towards something more, a little kinetic. I deployed to Afghanistan as a cook. So I actually went from cooking from the admiral and his staff to cooking in an army chow hall, a FOB in Afghanistan for 500-600 NATO troops. That was pretty funny too, because there were a few platoons of Italian special forces right there on that base. So I got to practice a little bit of the lingo that I'd learned in Italy, in Afghanistan. And I got to trade MREs for the good espresso they brought in. But that's when I met some EOD techs, Explosive Ordnance Disposals, the military's bomb squad. And I met these guys. And it was as soon as I learned about their job, the tight-knit community, the fact that they're first responders on the battlefield, that technical know-how, you know, you get to actually exercise your brain, and you need not just know-how, but you need a whole bunch of creativity and everything about it. I zeroed right in, and I knew that's what I had to do. Of course, the Navy immediately denied my request to switch from cooking to bomb defusing. I guess they like my cooking too much. So when I returned from Afghanistan as a cook, my contract was near an end. It was time to either re-enlist or hang it up. And I just left one uniform for another one. And I joined the Army, became an EOD technician, and soon I found myself in Iraq. And then not much longer after that, in 2011, I was back in Afghanistan, this time as an EOD team leader, the guy who actually gets in the bomb suit and makes that long, lonely walk. And about 8 months into a 12-month deployment is when, you know, that one had my name on it.
If you don't mind, knowing you do public speaking and knowing you've probably told the story, I'm going to push and ask, do you mind going into kind of what happened that day? Like, I haven't heard the details of what went down. I'm interested in that moment and then kind of what came after as we kind of learned about the guy that we're talking to.
Of course. Yeah, I was actually just coming home from 2 weeks of R&R, vacation, leave time back in the United States. We spent it in the DC area. I got to see my firstborn, my only son at the time, turn one. I'd already been deployed for most of his life. I got to witness the whole family gather around for Thanksgiving. It was a pretty amazing last page in the that mental photo album. Then I had to fly back to Afghanistan, get back to work for the final 3.5 months of my deployment. Our armored truck picked me up at the airfield. I threw the bags in the back of the truck on the robot. And we jumped into a supply convoy to head right back out to our AO, area of operation. And along the way, the patrol leader called back to our truck and said, hey, the Afghan National Police have located something along the road up ahead. And quick reaction force, the actual guys on duty are so far away. You know, we have an EOD team in our convoy. Will you take a look at it? Of course. So I threw the luggage off the robot out of the truck, and we got to work. And we found what we've been finding almost entirely, exclusively. It was these very rudimentary vegetable oil jugs full of homemade explosives connected to a pressure plate made out of simple plywood, a 9-volt battery, and some lamp cord connecting the whole thing. Simple, simple circuit. It's so simple, it's effective. And they just had them buried everywhere. Every single step on our deployment was a conscious decision.
Wow.
And there was another one. So we had the robot take care of business. We didn't even leave the truck until it was taken apart. But part of my job on the battlefield is it's kind of like your battlefield CSI. I want to collect evidence and send it up to higher so we can do biometrics, chemical analysis, electronic analysis, all that stuff. And this kind of evidence goes to all those other departments like DIA, CIA, FBI, ATF, DEF, all those guys. And these storyboards go out to all of those intelligence agencies so we can get ahead of the bomb placers, the bomb makers, the bomb financiers, all that. So the only problem was the robot could not get the jug pulled out of the hard packed dirt. All I did was grab my evidence kit and metal detector, and I jumped up. And about 20 meters or so from the original device, there was a secondary device that hadn't yet been detected until I walked right over it. The blast punted me into the air. The lights went out. And I landed on my knees and elbows. I was still conscious. I can't tell you that I was lucid, but I was still awake. But it was pitch dark. And the first thing I thought was my helmet had been pushed over my face. So the first thing I did was wiggle the fingers and toes, knees and elbows, and make sure everything was still attached. And, you know, do a quick functions check. Then I reached up to fix my helmet, just to find that the helmet was gone. And my first thought was, oh no, this is bad. My first sergeant's going to kill me for losing that helmet. But Then the next thing that I knew was going to happen, military training just kicking in automatically. You know, that complex ambush where they set off an IED, they cause a little chaos, and then they start shooting. And that's what I thought was going to happen. And at the same time, I know that my team, their SOP, the standard operating procedure, is to clear a safe path to the team leader that went down so that medics can get in and get me out. But I knew that my legs were still good. So I stood up and I started walking back to the truck. Of course, I had no idea where that truck was anymore. So I'm just basically doing a zombie walk around the battlefield, probably making it more dangerous for everybody. But again, I had my bell rung pretty good. Finally, my team grabbed me and dragged me back to safety. And within 14 minutes, the medevac chopper was taking me right back to that airfield.
So it's interesting because as we were talking through this, I think we probably assumed that there was a loss of consciousness, right? So to hear you talk about kind of being conscious through the whole thing, being able to get airlifted, because I just would have assumed, hey, you wake up and what happened? So talk us through, like, at what point do you remember things starting to settle in or realizing, okay, I think things have changed, right? This is different now.
I've lost my vision.
Right. And I don't know if that was something that sunk in right away or if that was a later after an assessment. Talk us through those kind of like right after events. You realize that you have lost the vision. What happens then?
It's kind of funny that you mentioned that about going unconscious. I remember the thinking was the situational awareness, my team, the enemy, what was going on. And it wasn't until I got on that medevac chopper and they had me strapped in that it was almost like I knew it was okay to let down my guard. And that's when I passed out. I woke up and I was in Kandahar again, briefly. And then the next thing I remember, I was in Landstuhl. I think I had to wait 24 hours because they would observe me because of the brain swelling. They didn't want me to do that transatlantic high altitude flight. It was about 48 hours before I was actually in, it was at Walter Reed in Bethesda. But everything the whole time, it was, and even after I'd arrived at the Naval Medical Center, it was kind of a whirlwind. There's just nurses and doctors and their veteran service organizations and admin people coming and going. It was just, there wasn't time to really think until it was nighttime. And I quickly learned that with 100% blindness, there's also the added gift of sleep disorder called non-24. You can't reset or wind your internal clock because we have this circadian rhythm. Our body's, you know, clock, that sleep wake routine is literally set to sunrise and sunset. You might be almost completely blind, but just have a little bit of light perception, you're okay. You know, 100% blindness, it's like being on a 26-hour clock. And it's just always a bit off. So I'm sitting, you know, laying in the hospital bed at Walter Reed, middle of the night, it's like 3-4 in the morning, wide awake, and just thinking about, well, one, why the heck can't I fall asleep? But also, is this going to be my life from now on? The doctors tried to save one of my eyes after the surgery. They just realized that it was just too far gone. So that's when I got confirmation that I was going to be blind for the rest of my life. And laying there in that hospital bed, you know, tubes and wires and all that kind of stuff going on, and I'm just laying there. You know, those self-defeating thoughts, the why me, the what ifs. Yeah, I call them my little demons whispering the questions that can never be answered. Right? What if I'd done something a little bit differently? And why did it have to be me? You know, I trained so hard, and we're the best fighting military on the planet. How did these low tech insurgents? It was a really hard pill to swallow.
Sure.
And I realized that I was going into this spiral of just self-defeat and depression. It wasn't going to work. And I had a couple of things going for me. One was just the incredible support system of my family. My mom, who had already been through tragedy once before with my younger brother, he'd been through a catastrophic roadside accident when he was working construction. He sustained permanent brain damage and injury as well. So my mom comes in and she's nothing but optimism. And the first thing I said to her was like, I am so sorry, Mom. I'm so sorry that I did this to your other son. She said, oh, honey, not my first rodeo. We'll be fine.
It's a good mom.
And that's amazing.
Yeah. I know she was hurt. She was sad. In fact, imagine when I told her I was joining the Navy to be a cook and time of peace. And I told her, Mom, I'll be fine. If war breaks out, I'm in the middle of the ocean, miles away from land and fighting. And then I decided to change jobs. But the other thing was I began thinking about all the other warriors up and down those halls of Walter Reed. They're all fighting their own personal battles. They're not giving up. Who am I to say that I have some kind of monopoly on pain, that my situation was the worst, and that I have a good excuse to quit? I don't. I didn't. And I had to put my big boy pants on. I had to put my sergeant, staff sergeant hat back on. I had to act and behave like Aaron Hale. Staff Sergeant Aaron Hale, EOD team leader, father, son, husband. If I was going to be a blind person for the rest of my life, then I better start being the best darn blind person I can be.
So a quick question for you. Did that realization or that reckoning, if you will, of how you began to re-identify yourself as Aaron Hale, right, in that moment, did that happen while you were at the hospital still, or did that come after?
It comes in stages and in waves, and it's a bit of an ebb and flow. You get like motivation. It's like hitting the wall. I feel down on myself, and then I'd say, I can do this. But then, you get another piece of bad news. We can't save that eye. And then, I'm being frustrated in the middle of the night by the sleep disorder and not getting any sleep, and finally fall asleep about 20 minutes before the nurses start walking in and saying, it's time to get up. We need to do tests and you need x-rays and stuff like that. And I'm like, I just fell asleep. What helped was just maybe 2 weeks before I'd been injured, when I was still in D.C., I was on my vacation. I was visiting family and watching my son have his birthday. It was a fellow team leader in my company who'd been injured. I hurried over to Walter Reed. I was there 2 weeks before I'd become a patient. I was the first one to be able to see my friend come out of the ICU. They wouldn't tell me what was wrong, what had happened to him, privilege. But they said I could wait in his room when he comes out of surgery. He'd be out any minute now. So I went into his room, and right beside his hospital bed was one of those chairs and had a stack of clothes donated by some organization. It was sweat pants and shorts and a t-shirt and a sweatshirt, and laying right on top of the whole stack was one shoe. You don't have to be a rocket scientist. My buddy Kyle gets wheeled in, and he's only got one leg now. He's got the best personality and far better sense of humor than I do. And I don't know if it was that or anesthesia he was probably still, feeling the effects of. But he sees me, he gets this huge grin, he goes, "Hail, dude. what are you doing here? He almost conspiratorially whispers to me and goes, I think I kicked myself in the face. The worst thing you could say about it that whole day was, man, that ruined a really awesome, beautiful calf tattoo. 2 weeks later, I'm sharing the unit with him just down the hall. And I'm feeling down on myself. I'm not nearly as upbeat as he was. And he comes wheeling in. He goes, hey, buddy, give me your hand. You got to check this out. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he grabs my wrist and he puts it up under his chin. Of course, I'm hesitating because I'm military and I know antics. But he puts his my palm of my hand and he has me cup his chin and he's got this 2 week growth of beard. And he goes, the Marine EOD techs have this liaison guy. As soon as they come out of surgery, he asks them how they're doing. If they say they're okay, which all Marines have to say, it's like their law, he hands them a razor and he says, get back in rigs. We don't have a liaison, man. It's dry. It's driving them crazy. You got to grow your beard out. I couldn't help but laugh. And that was it. I mean, that's looks like the whole secret to everything is you got to find the bright side. Every situation, there's something to learn, you know, especially in the hardest times, right? You got to have that release valve. You got to look for the silver lining. And that was his example. I need to laugh and I need to look at the bright side.
Man, there's so many things that jumped out at me when you told that story. We had a guest, Marcus Smith, who had a traumatic accident, not to the extent of yours. But I remember him talking about in his episode of kind of what you said is, hey, there's questions that you're never going to have answers to. And a big part of it is accepting the fact that you'll never have answers to those questions. And it sounds like you went through something similar. And obviously what we're talking about here was life-changing for you. We are going to be talking about how some of these lessons have impacted, you know, your ultra running journey, right? And how you take some of this mindset into that. And it seems so insignificant, but I think a lot of those listening and myself, right, have been on a trail somewhere and something happens and you go, oh, how can this be happening? Why now? Why this? I'm prepared. You know, why do I have this blister or whatever? And the few things that you talked about with that, like, hey, sometimes you don't have to worry about answering the question. You just got to work on kind of like, okay, here's my situation and accept and move forward. And then I love your story about your, you know, your buddy and finding the silver lining and being able to move forward. But I think my favorite thing that you talked about there was it's time to be Staff Sergeant Aaron Hale and stepping into who you knew you could be. I think that's a really powerful thing for kind of anything, right? And sometimes I think we say, oh, here's the thing I need to do. Sometimes I think saying, here's the person I know I can be. Is that's something I think I'm going to kind of hang on to and think about more.
There are a lot of lessons I've learned from the military that have helped me get through the trauma of losing my eyesight, then later my hearing. I love how General Jim Mattis, you know, he said in his book, Call Sign Chaos, he said, at least in the Marines, things being hard were never a good excuse for mission failure. And I always picture back to EOD, and at least in the Army, every three EOD tech team is given this huge quad con. It's like over a third of the size of one of those huge shipping containers. And it's loaded with tools, bomb suits, robots, hazmat kits, everything for us to fight. Everything that explodes from bullets to weapons of mass destruction and nuclear bombs. So we have a tool or tools for all those scenarios. And then we get to, you know, we go down deployment and we get that the armored truck I was talking about. And it can't fit all of those tools and us. So we have to leave a few of those tools behind. And we have to basically do a tool triage. And we still have a job to do. We can't just say, oh, we left that tool behind. We got to figure out how to do it without that, with the equipment we have on hand. Then we get to Afghanistan and we're on dismounted patrols. We're on foot. So we can only bring along whatever we can carry on our backs. We still have the same mission. We can't just say, oh, sorry, guys, let's, you know, walk around that explosive hazard just for, you know, kick some dirt over it and call it a day. We got to still do the job. So it takes, you know, a whole lot of creativity. We got to figure it out somehow, and we got to continue the mission. So here I am missing. I had to leave a few tools behind. I can't just sit around and grouse and complain all day and for the rest of my life that it would be a lot easier if I had my eyes and my hearing, and I'll just wait. Or to sit here and feel sorry for myself. I got to carry on and I got to continue the mission.
So I've been pretty quiet, I know, because I am spellbound listening to you, to your story, because it's a whole different world for me, obviously, listening to everything you went through. And we kind of mentioned this in the introduction that, you know, you lost your vision and then you lost your hearing 4 years later. And we've kind of almost made both of those happen at the same time, the way we kind of talked about it, but they really didn't. To hear that you went through all of this, you had to kind of start getting this personal acceptance, the fact that you know, had no longer had your vision, and you started putting your life back together best you could with not being able to see. 4 years later is not like a 24-hour window. Like, that's a long time of life happening that all of a sudden you're going to have another major setback. So just for those listening, and we did our own little research, we kind of learned how you lost it, but could you share about why or how you lost your hearing?
Yeah, absolutely. The blast from the IED not only damaged my eyes, and the blast was, you know, that blast wave was strong enough to rip the helmet right off of my head, the eye protection off of my face, and my eyeballs right out of my head. So suffice it to say, it also did a little bit more damage. It had cracked my skull. I was actually leaking spinal fluid right out my nose. And when I got to Walter Reed, they did all that they could to repair my eyes. And they also did what's called an encephalus seal, where they take a piece of septum, you know, a piece of cartilage from my nose, and try to patch those cracks. And did the best they could, but I guess over the, you know, next 4 years, I still had a small leak, and a path out is also a pathway in. And this bacteria crept in. In that time, I was beginning to learn how to be a blind person. I started researching how to do things as a blind person. I went to the Blind Rehabilitation Center at the VA hospital in Augusta, Georgia. You know, I learned how to use accessibility tools and use my cane and get around and do things like how to learn tricks to keep my socks paired and stuff like that. How to, you know, do emails. And I also did a little research on what other blind people were doing to stay fit, get outside. A few names started coming up, like Eric Weinmayer is the first blind person to climb Mount Everest. You know, I sought him out and I went mountain climbing with him and joined a all wounded veteran climbing team up a 19,000 foot peak in the Peruvian Andes in 2013. Eric himself is not a veteran, but his dad is. So on the anniversary of him climbing Mount Everest, he started this program called Soldiers to Summits. There was another guy, Lonnie Bedwell, who is another Navy veteran, but though he didn't lose his sight in service, he says he was hunting with a buddy and his buddy Dick Cheney'd him. And, Lonnie is the first blind person to kayak the entire Grand Canyon in a solo boat. So I sought him out And I went kayaking with her, you know, just I kept doing all this stuff. And part of it was just out of sheer terror of being stuck inside by my condition, you know, maybe sitting on the couch feeling sorry for myself. It's actually a terrifying thought. So I kept trying to get outside and find these guys that were making things happen. They were doing it. They were showing the way. I wasn't blazing in any trail. I was just trying to live my life and show my kids, you know, that dad can still do anything. And then 4 years later, I'm doing all this adventuring stuff. I'm retired from the military, began speaking and traveling around. Then one day I was coming back from a speaking engagement and I was just flying back and I got back to the house. I was on the phone with my new girlfriend at the time. I remember feeling very fatigued and extremely dizzy for some reason. Laid down for a nap. And next thing I know, I'm waking up to this horrible, I don't know, the headache, migraine doesn't really do it enough justice. And within moments, I knew that I needed to call 911. I get to the hospital and it's like 4 days later when I actually am lucid enough to come to and find out what happened. And my girlfriend, Michaela, was right by my side. She was in California last night when I was on the phone with her, seemed like 5 minutes ago. And my mom was right by my side. She lives in Ohio. I'm in Florida. Like, what is going on here? I'd been in and out, but not at all lucid enough to know what was happening. I was confused and afraid and angry. And finally, when I'd calmed down and come to my senses, I found out that I'd contracted bacterial meningitis. It sounded like I was at the bottom of a pool, like I was congested, and my hearing was fading quickly. And the doctor told me what was going on and what was happening. I said, "Doctor, you're telling me that I'm going to be 100% deaf on top of being 100% blind? You mean to tell me that I'm never going to have to pretend to pay attention ever again?" There is a silver lining to everything, of course. But yeah, of course, those same thoughts, the same demons try to get in. I'm thinking, you know, when have I had my fair share? When's enough enough? And just like the added gift of the sleep disorder, when I lost my hearing, I also lost a good deal of my vestibular balance, that inner ear gyro. I actually learned through the whole process that we get our sense of balance three different ways. The inner ear, vestibular balance, we get it through sense of sight, you know, seeing ourselves in relationship to the world, and through touch, physical contact with the earth. And of course, if anybody's counting, I'm down 2 out of 3. I came home in a wheelchair. I was 2 weeks from flying to Tanzania to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And there I was back in the hospital thinking, I wonder if I can get out there in time. It definitely wasn't in the cards. I was in the hospital for over a month. Bacteria actually nearly killed me. But when I came home in a wheelchair, I was just sitting there at my kitchen counter, the breakfast bar, holding on by one hand because I might just fall right off the stool. Sitting there feeling sorry for myself, defeated, right? Everything that I'd been using as an accessibility device was audio-based. I couldn't listen to my audiobooks or podcasts. I couldn't read my emails. I could not get a message in at all. I had that support system. Michaela, my girlfriend, moved in. She helped nurse me back to health. I had to turn it around. It's, you know, originally was asking myself, why is this happening to me? Why me again? Right. But it was the wrong question, because when you're asking those questions that can never be answered, it's just frustrating and it's depressing. It ends up in that spiral. Instead, I started looking outward. First, I just needed something to do. I had to figure out something to do, because not only was I getting angry and depressed, but I was also getting bored. I'm just sitting around. I needed to keep busy, right? The very first thing is just take action. So I went back to cooking. And it was right about the holiday time, and Thanksgiving was around the corner. So I started cooking. I started preparing for a huge Thanksgiving feast. We're going to invite the whole family from all over the country. We're going to invite some neighbors and friends. And I was cooking. I started cooking weeks in advance. And I started making these desserts, cakes and pies and cookies. And I started making fudge, right? And, you know, batch after batch, I'd make one and I'd switch up the recipe a little bit. And it was like peanut butter. And then it was, white chocolate and candy cane. And then it was bags of peanut butter because I like peanut butter. And then nuts and then spices. And I go to the liquor cabinet, a little bit in there, a little bit for me. And then Michaela noticed two things. One was something she hadn't seen in nearly 6 months since the illness has, come on. There's a smile on my face. And the other thing she noticed was that the fudge was just piling up. There's more than we could finish. So she started sneaking it out the front door to give away to friends and neighbors. I see sneaking. You got to be real stealthy around a blind deaf guy. But she was giving it away. And people are coming back and asking if they could buy some from us. And the capitalist in me said, well, of course you may. And all of a sudden, we had this business. At the same time, I'd also decided that I wasn't going to be trapped by my wobbly legs and this balance thing. If I still had one way to gain my balance, I was going to develop that last, the sense of touch as best I could. So I started working out. Of course, it was the treadmill was a challenge because it not only was it moving one direction, it was moving in all directions now. that was me. So I would hit the quick start button and I would hold on for dear life as I just walked half a mile an hour. And then I would gradually hit that, arrow up on the speed button and just gradually start walking a little bit faster and then faster. And then I was jogging. Really developing my arms at the same time. But I would take the trekking poles that I'd used once in the mountains, and I would use them like an extra pair of, like an antennae and an extra pair of set of legs. And I would do this weird extended crab walk thing out to my mailbox and back. And I'd be exhausted and sweating. I mean, it was Florida anyways. But
I hear that.
And then I would go a little further and go down to the neighborhood gate and back. And over time, it was little step after little step that got a little bit bigger and a little bit faster. And I started, able to walk again. And it took a while, but 1 year after the meningitis, I ran my first marathon. Back in my hometown of Ohio, the Akron Marathon. I'd actually reached out to Team Red, White, and Blue, who sent like a whole team of people to help guide me through the marathon. And I totally underestimated the Cuyahoga River Valley Hills. But they had people like halfbacks running, blocking up ahead, blind runner coming through. And they had my guide on one side, another guy on the other side. And as my balance, get all my balance from my muscles and nerves. And as you get more fatigued, of course, I would get more, imbalanced. So I was bracketed in by these guys. I was bouncing shoulder to shoulder, but it became my first sub-4-hour marathon, and it still is my PR. And it's the same week of my 20th high school reunion. So back in my hometown, doing this comeback run from another near-death experience, and I had a pretty heck of a good showing at the marathon. And then I got to hang out with some of my buddies and show off another race medal. It was a pretty cool comeback.
That's so cool.
It's incredible to get a sub-4-hour marathon just in general for a lot of people. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, man. So I'm blown away. We're going to talk some. I'm very interested in your mindset, kind of routine, what your resources are, that kind of thing. But to hear that story of the comeback, the setback, the comeback, and then obviously knowing that you just finished Badwater, right? Something that a few people on the planet will ever do, including, you know, the majority of ultra runners who are already doing things that the average population often would say is impossible. So you ran that marathon. I hear that. What got you to the point? Because like we said in the intro, so tell me if I'm right. I counted, at least looking at ultra sign up, you've completed a 100-mile distance at least four times. So the Canal Corridor, you ran twice, Daytona 100, and then the Badwater 135. Am I missing any other big events?
I did a 12-hour. Was a little over 50 miles. That was my first ultra. And it was the Southern Discomfort in Albany, Georgia.
I guess from the marathon, what got you to do the 12-hour? And then when was it that you said, okay, I'm interested in tackling 100-mile distance? Because we've got a lot of people listening now, right, that are interested in ultras, that are gearing up for their first 50K, that are thinking, hey, I'd like to do a 100-miler one day, but I haven't talked myself into the fact that it's possible. But now you've done it without the benefit of sight or sound.
And balance, primarily
balance. And so they're listening. And hopefully if you're listening, your excuses just went out the window, right? But at what point did you decide like, oh, I want to do that?
It seemed like the next progression. And I don't know, it's this frame of mind that tells me that I need to be improving. I need to be growing. I need to be challenging myself. Because I also feel that the opposite, there is no real like stasis. There's not a status quo. If I'm sitting still, I move backwards, really. You know, if I sit down too long, I'm going to get sloppy, lazy. And doing the same thing over and over again kind of seems boring again. So I needed to find another challenge. I love marathons and I still do marathons. In fact, that Akron Marathon, one month later, I was running the Marine Corps Marathon, and both of them were sub-4 and qualified me for Boston. And I ran Boston. But after that, it was like a decision point. Do I go for faster or do I go for longer? And I'd heard about this Badwater 135, and it sounded terrifying and awesome. Yeah, like, holy crap, that's scary. I got to do that. And that's what it was. It scared the pants off me. And that's probably what attracted me to it. So I decided to go longer. And, you know, I had to qualify for that, just like I had to qualify for Boston. I had to do at least 3 100s, and it better be hot ones. Of course, Canal Corridor and Akron, not real hot. In fact, the second one was pretty darn cold. Every time I stopped in the middle of the night, it was like in the 30s or 40s. My muscles would just seize up. But Daytona, that sure was a good hot one. That was miserable. It was so humid. I was dripping all day, all night. And there was just no relief. There's nowhere for my sweat to go and wick the heat off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was pretty brutal. That was definitely, of the 3 100s, that was definitely the crucible. But it was all in preparation for Badwater. Of course, none of them were all that hilly. In Daytona, not a whole lot of altitude gain there.
No giant mountains in Florida.
And the Canal Corridor only has 800 feet of elevation, so they're both pretty flat.
Yep.
I think the highest point in all of Florida is, 382 feet or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Aaron,
it makes me ask a question. You said that you got drawn to the idea of Badwater because it was terrifying. If you had not had, if you'd not gone through your accident, if you had not lost your vision and not lost your hearing, do you think the Aaron before that would have signed up for Badwater?
I'm not sure if I'd ever heard, I would have ever heard of it. I don't know. It's one of those lessons that the trauma, the catastrophe, this whole ordeal has taught me is that someday will never come. Mm-hmm. And I was telling myself someday a lot. You know, it would be really cool to climb Everest someday. It'd be really cool to start investing in my, you know, learning how to be financially literate and investing for my future. Yeah, someday. And today, I'll go out with the boys and have a good time. It would be really good to get fit and healthy someday. You know, all those things. But it never happens. Because today, I'm too used to the comfort of where I am. So just thinking about it, I probably might not have ever learned about Badwater or ultra marathons, maybe. But I probably would never have gotten off my butt to do something like that.
That is, to me, and I may be misinterpreting, to me, it's one of those life lessons that at some point in our lives, we have to figure out how to start living our actual life.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think that's really powerful for you to say that it's like your entire life came into a different perspective now.
It's one of those things that I had to learn the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things, you know, I preach from the mountaintops. Don't tell people, and when I'm in my speaking engagements, is that, you know, pain is inevitable. Hardship is going to happen. You can be ready for it, or it can happen to you. But, you know, you can even have some self-induced hardship, like Badwater. But one way or another, you're going to have to go through some hard times. You're going to have to get uncomfortable. But the good thing is, if you're paying attention, you can learn from it and you can get stronger. You can actually enjoy the process. There's some trauma that's absolutely horrible. But like I said, there's a silver lining and you can learn something. And you can stop asking, why is this happening to me? You can ask, why is this happening for me? You can go a step further and ask, why is this happening for me so that I can help others? I can teach and I can pass it on.
That's powerful.
So did Badwater give you everything you hoped it would?
Did Badwater?
Yeah. Did your experience at Badwater give you everything you hoped it would when you started thinking about signing up for it?
It was definitely a butt kicker. Oh my God. I tell you what, though, when you are in alignment with, you know, your goals and your preparation, and you've got the right circle around you, you got the right team. I had the perfect crew for me, for that course, for that time. I prepared really well. And even being in, you know, the flatlands of Florida, I had a couple things going for me. One, that humidity. I pretty much lived on my treadmill. I spent more time on my treadmill in my garage and with the garage door closed. So it was like one of those old, you know, one of those old turn of the century prison camp hot boxes. And I had a treadmill going. I'd actually years ago installed an air conditioning unit, one of those ductless ones that were right over my head. I had a box fan and an oscillating fan in there to make that place nice and comfortable, but they hadn't been turned on in years. And I just sweat and ran and drank and, you know, drop electrolyte capsules and I would put on my weight vest and I'd crank the incline up and I'd prepare for the, you know, the hills ahead. And, you know, then I would cross training and I would, you know, just, I would prepare the best I could. Another saying from the military, right, is sweat in training so you don't bleed in battle. I knew the bad water was going to try to kill me. Mm-hmm. And I had this amazing team. I had Lisa Smith Batchen, who's maybe one of the best, you know, running coaches out there. Definitely. I mean, she's amazing. She knows that course. She's run it 11 times, I think 10 times officially. She's done the Badwater Quad. She ran from Las Vegas to the start.
Wow.
And then ran it. Yeah. I mean, she's in the Badwater Hall of Fame. I had Vincent Antunes, who's Mr. Trail Toes himself. He's a army doctor, invented the anti-friction goop for your feet and other body parts. And you can't have somebody better than an orthopedic doctor working on taping you. And then, you know, Catherine Agazinski and my friend David Kelly, who also is one of those hard as nails ranger, you know, types. And they had a plan. They were keeping track of my pace, when to push me, when to hold me back, when to feed me. You know, they just knew, and everything was clicking. So yeah, as hard as that course was, we crushed the first time hack at what, 50.8 miles. We were 5 hours ahead of the cutoff. And you gotta remember that I've only done the minimum requirement to qualify, 3 100s. All three of those 100s have never done better than 30 minutes from the cutoff time. So I've only barely finished any of those races. And to come in the first 50 miles, 5 hours at a time, I'm like, man, let's go jump in the pool. But of course, the first 50 miles are pretty good and flat. You know, the test, I call it bad water kindergarten. You know, my real education was about to get started. And I started, you know, I was getting into the mountains and the climbs. They were so brutal. Plus, I was doing a completely untested guiding system. So you guys haven't even asked how I won.
I was gonna tell people that I saw the video that Badwater posted, and it looked like you have a pacer that's in front of you, and they're holding two poles, PVC pipe looking like, and you're holding the other ends of them. Is that how you run?
Well, that's how I did Badwater, but I've never done that before in my life.
That had to be an adjustment.
Far more simple than that setup we had. I, for the last almost 10 years now, have been running with a very simple tether. In fact, I started with one of those dog tug of war ropes with a knot on each end. And I would, you know, like 1 foot long, 6 inches long, something like that. And I would hold a knot, my guide would hold a knot, and then we'd run side by side. And I'd get all my cues from that rope. And that's how we ran. But just, you know, we got there a couple of days early, and we actually wanted to, you know, train together for the first time. And we realized that Badwater was single track the whole way. Mm-hmm. We couldn't run side by side. So we had to come up with something really fast. And, you know, just anticipating something like that, it just, maybe it was just sure dumb luck, but I brought my trekking poles with me, the same ones that I took into the mountains and the same ones that got me to and from the mailbox. And what we did is, you know, I would hold on to the handles, and there was a lot of testing, you know, to figure out how to do this. But we started with one trekking pole, and I would be able to keep that forward, backward distance, but there was too much swing, and I could swing right out into the road or off the, you know, the lip of the road. So we did two, and instead of holding the tips of the trekking poles, we actually taped the tips to the pacer's bib, you know, the waist belt. So, every time, you know, my guide, And we just rotated three of them. When they rotated out, they would just unclip the pacer belt, switch over, and they were good to go. And because the poles were attached to their hips, this was the coolest part. See, with that tether in the past I was using, I was running and I had to keep my arm, pretty much my elbow, locked at a 90 degree angle to because I've never figured out how to do natural arm swing and hold on a tether, you know, attached to somebody else. And it developed knots and it's so much pain up in my shoulder blades, my traps and my delts. I think I've actually developed some arthritis up there from it. What was great about the tracking pole thing is because the tips were attached to my guide's hips, they were actually pumping like sideways pistons. And that means that my hands were kind of moving in the natural locomotion that they were supposed to. And it was huge fear and weight off my shoulders, literally, because I was afraid that I'd be in more pain in my shoulder than I would be in my feet or anywhere else. It's pretty dramatic, the pain over, you know, just a few minutes to a few hours, but to go 40 some hours holding the, you know, that tension like that. So to have discovered one, a way to run single file, and then I could actually have a natural arm swing. It was amazing. It was so great.
It goes back to, you were talking about your tools, and we've talked a lot on this show about problem solving and those types of things. To hear you've solved that problem right before the race, especially when you show up and probably realize like, uh-oh, my plan is not going to work.
But it wasn't just me. It was right. My whole team. We put our heads together and collectively came up with this, and we came up with it really fast. And it was the taping, and it was a little trial and error. And then there was the other thing about me not being able to hear a damn thing. So, and my guide, if they needed to say speed up or slow down or we're stopping, they'd have to, you know, crane their neck over their shoulder to yell behind them. And they were, you know, of course, they still got to keep moving forward, and they're attached at the hip to these trekking poles. So they got to be careful not to steer me in the wrong direction while trying to talk to me. So, you know, I think it was Vincent that came up with the whistle idea, or maybe it was Coach Lisa, but we did a whistle system where one blast of the whistle, one tweet of the whistle was walk, two was run, and three was stop. Of course, you know, 30 some hours into the race and everybody forgets what it is, but I know if we're running and you do three, you know, two blasts, and like, yeah, you're probably stopping.
That's awesome. Well, let me ask this, because I know from your emails, I mean, obviously you're not going to get through bad water without having tough moments, right? And from your email, you said that there was some of your lowest kind of ultra moments happened. As a mindset guy, what do you tell yourself on the course when things get challenging? Like, what's the first thing that comes to mind when it gets hard?
One, I remind myself that this is exactly why I'm out here. I'm coming for this moment exactly. You know, they say in a marathon, mile 20, you're halfway there.
Yep.
Yeah. And you have those moments, sometimes multiple moments, where you hit that wall. And it's a combination of nutrition or fatigue or whatever it is that, you know, negative self-talk. But you hit that moment, that decision point, when that voice in your head, those little demons in your head, I'm telling you, it's too hard. You have to stop. You can't make it. That's why I do it. I want to keep facing my demons, and I want to keep facing them down. I want to keep conquering my toughest adversary is myself. I had no doubt that I could do it. If I could conquer my own self-doubt, I'd already run Badwater 1,000 times on my treadmill. I'd already won, you know, 1,000 times with a weight vest and a kettlebell. And I'd broken my body down and built it back up. The other thing I tell myself is that I am so lucky that I am able to do these amazing things, is that I'm alive, and that I'm just so lucky that I get to be out here doing stuff like this. And I'm lucky to be around people like, you know, who I had my crew and the other people in that ultra community and all those amazing people that greeted me and greeted my team when we crossed the finish line. There's so many amazing stories of people that are there. And it's hard to describe just how terrific. It's like the church of, you know, long distance running, you know? So when I'm at my worst, I just remember those few little things. And I'm lucky. This is why I'm here. I've got some amazing people around me cheering me on and supporting me.
It's amazing how powerful gratitude can be. And I don't know if you had a chance to cross paths with Emily Lyons, or if that name rings a bell. She was out there. We had her on the show just a few guests ago, and she's just an amazing human being. But so it was fun to follow her journey as well. But keeping on the topic of mindset, one of the things that you said earlier, you said like motivation, right? Ebbs and flows. And I remember hearing some kind of comment, and it's really about mindset, or it's probably personal development. That's kind of like, you know, a shower, like you got to do it every day. You know, you take a shower to get clean, but you don't stay clean for long unless you make it a habit. And personal development and mindset is very similar. And so I'm interested in, do you have favorite resources or books or something that you would recommend to our listeners if that's something they want to work on, or give them something to plug into?
Well, I'm a pretty voracious audiobook and podcast listener. A couple really do jump out at me, like The Happiness Advantage. Is that it? Yeah, The Happiness Advantage. It's a really good one.
As a podcast or a book?
That is a book.
Okay.
The Happiness Advantage. That's Sean Aker. Resilience. Hard-won wisdom. And it's a Navy SEAL. Eric Greitens actually was the became governor of Missouri. He had a fellow Navy SEAL who's having a hard time, PTSD, alcohol, and he started writing these letters to him. And the whole book is basically a letter to his, you know, Navy SEAL brother, all about resilience. It's an amazingly great book. It really breaks down how we deal with and how we build up our resilience. Those are two really good ones. Plus there's mindset. You know, the difference between a fixed and a growth mindset. We kind of move back and gravitate back and forth at, you know, times between fixed and growth mindsets. It's good to know when you're in one or the other.
Great recommendations. I've really enjoyed the conversation. We're getting close to wrapping up here, but I mentioned in the intro that you use your story to help other people. Tell us about Building Homes for Heroes and why it means so much to you.
I'm coming to you from a Building Homes for Heroes home. In 2013, Building Homes for Heroes gave me this specially adapted house mortgage free. And they've been doing this since 2007 or so. And their mission is to give specially adapted mortgage free homes to severely wounded service members, veterans, Gold Star families, and first responders. They're actually on pace to gift one of these houses to somebody, a deserving service member or family, one every 11 days.
Amazing.
And in 2024, they're also on track to hitting 400 homes given. So I ran Badwater, not just for myself, but for my fellow wounded service members.
And so if somebody's listening and wants to learn more about Building Homes for Heroes, it's buildinghomesforheroes.org. But is there a way that they should get involved? Is there somewhere to send them? Do you have a specific link, or is buildinghomesforheroes.org the best place to go?
Absolutely. They can go to buildinghomesforheroes.org, and I can give you my, you know, my special fundraiser page.
Absolutely.
If you want to put that in the show notes.
Absolutely. We'll link the notes. I did. It's interesting. I was doing some research and I went on to that site and read a little bit about their story. And it sounds like the founder, it was actually the aftermath of 9/11. Was working side by side with the first responders and just the things that he saw and said, hey, I want to do things for, you know, these people, for the people that really sacrificed for our country. So pretty neat story too. I recommend checking that out.
So how long have you been raising support for Building Homes for Heroes?
Frankly, I've been doing it ever since they discovered me. I've been trying to, I mean, love the mission. And so I volunteer to speak on their behalf all the time. And I do fundraisers, you know, their events. So I'll keynote for them. Or you know, they do their golf outings, but I'm not a terrific golfer. although I have cut a couple swings off my game ever since I stopped watching the ball.
Full of jokes. I love the jokes. All right. Well, here's the deal. We're going to wrap up, but a couple things I want to make sure if you're listening, obviously we're going to put the notes and we mentioned on the intro Point of Impact podcast. I've listened to a few of the episodes. Talk about mindset. You really are bringing on people and having great discussions on there. So if you're listening, go check out the Point of Impact podcast. Also, if you got a sweet tooth like me, you talked about the fudge and that's turned into EOD fudge, Extraordinary Delights, which is obviously a great play on the EOD. I absolutely plan to order some. So is peanut butter, is that what I should go with based off of your previous comment?
You know, I love the peanut butter, and ours is like a white chocolate and a peanut butter and a caramel in between.
Ooh, man.
But my favorite flavor is actually a kind of a original concoction from my time in Italy. It's an all-American version of tiramisu, which literally in Italian, tiramisu means pick me up. Tirare mi su, pick me up. And because it's got a little booze, it's got a little coffee, it's got the cocoa, you know, it's got all that, you know, nice stuff. So what I did is I made this white chocolate bourbon cream instead of Frangelico. Instead of hazelnuts, I put all American pecans in there. And then a dark chocolate instead of espresso. I actually found a coffee roaster called American Pride Roasters. Yeah, so it's a American pick me up.
American.
I like it. I say either order some fudge or listen to the podcast. But to me, the most inspiring thing is just who you are and kind of everything you've gone through. The work you're doing with this, the Building Homes for Heroes, is really something I think that we should all check out. It is a great organization. It's a great mission that what they're trying to do. And to get to 400 homes for those really that are deserving of it is just an impressive organization to be a part of. And so I appreciate you sharing what you're doing with them and just sharing your story with us. It's been incredible to hear it. We joked in the very beginning before we started recording that I'm a civilian. I'm not like you two that have the military background. I get just enthralled listening to the story. And I can't imagine what it takes to do what you've done. And so I do respect that a lot. And I just appreciate it. So thank you so much for being open and transparent with everything.
No, you're very welcome. And thank you guys for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And to the Ultra Running Guys family, as always, we appreciate you. We can't tell you how much we appreciate you. We'll put all of Aaron's information in the notes. And if you like what you're hearing, go give us the review, the star rating, all that stuff. But we are going to keep you around, Aaron, for a quick segment for Patreon. But for everybody else, we'll talk soon and cut.
This isn't a hearing aid. It sends a digital signal to my auditory nerve, and it's Bluetooth connected to my blind accessible phone and computer and all that. And then of course we're connected via the internet. It's amazing. Of course, it's 101 ways I could screw something up.
Yeah, I have zero military background, so I asked a lot of dumb questions and he laughs at me. So now I have two people who can laugh at me as well from a civilian standpoint who has absolutely zero idea of what we're talking about.
I'll point it out every time you say something.
You often do.
Thank you, by the way, for your service.
Oh, well, same to you. And I'm sure I'll say it during the show too.
Can I pause for a moment? Y'all find this ironic that military folks say that to each other and people like myself rarely say it at all?
A lot more people than you would expect do say it.
Yeah, I've never told you. Jokes. He's like, they're really good friends.
If you could play an instrument well, what would you play?
Spoons.
That was so quick.
The good news is we edit. And since if there's something that I say or Jeremy says and you want us to repeat it, just ask and we will definitely repeat it. And it's not a problem at all.
What? You're wasting all the best conversation. Let's hit record.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, listen, thank you so much. We recognize the fact that you are probably just hanging on just for a couple more minutes as you're finishing up your run. But really, we do want to give you a huge thank you for the constant support that you've shown us. We hear you and we feel you. And the best way for us to continue to grow is for you to share us with your friends. Tell them what you put in your ears when you're out there on a long run. Hit the like button, leave us a comment, leave a review, and give us some direct feedback on what you like about the show and also what you don't like. We're here to improve and do it for you.
And it really means the world. And listen, if you would like to support financially, you can connect with us on Patreon at patreon.com/theultrarunningguys, or you can use the support link in the show notes. Any and all support goes directly back into growing the show and helping us get better at what we love to do, which is to serve all of you. And with that, finish up that run, get cleaned up, and just show up.
Clean.
Clean.